Welcome back. This is 20 VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and today's a show I'm very passionate about, an incredible business leader who's changed their industry. But today we touch on a lot of very personal things that I don't think many have heard before, but I think are really meaningful, and so it makes it such a special show for me to do. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Ryan Smith, founder and executive chairman at Qualtrics, the leader in customer experience and creator of the experience management category. Ryan has scaled Qualtrics from a basement startup to one of the fastest growing technology companies in the world, with 25 offices globally and more than 13,000 customers. In the private markets, Qualtrics raised $400 million in funding from Accel, Sequoia and Insight Venture Partners. And 3 days before the company initially was scheduled to go public, SAP announced its intent to acquire Qualtrics for $8 billion, which was the largest private enterprise software acquisition ever. And then in 2020, Qualtrics and SAP announced plans to take Qualtrics public as an independently operated company. I do want to say a huge thank you to Ryan's brother Jared and Jeff Lieberman at Insight for some amazing question suggestions today. Really did make the schedule so much more special. But before we dive into the show today, I have to say I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of the incredible platform that is AngelList on the business side there, on the personal side, Harness is the next generation wealth management solution created for builders, individuals, founding, scaling, and investing in businesses. And if you're like me and not ready for an ongoing advisory relationship, then simple. Schedule a 1-hour tax planning session with a tax advisor experienced in working with equity. The accountant will review your equity and tax documents, answer any questions you may have, and provide projections for potential equity decisions. But don't just take my word for it. Harness have helped founders and early employees at companies like Stripe, UiPath, Affirm, and Coinbase capture more value with their finances. Go to harnesswealth.com/the20minute VC to sign up. Plus 20 VC listeners can receive $100 off their first year fees when they sign up for an advisor on the Harness platform by entering the 20 minute VC08. And speaking of wealth management with Harness there, Masterworks is the first platform for buying and selling shares, representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in the most incredible blue chip art, so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. And with more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks are the top buyer in the art market. So it's time to build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks. And you can find out more today at masterworks.io. But that is quite enough from me. So now I'm very, very excited for what is an incredible show with Ryan Smith, founder and executive chairman at Qualtrics.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Ryan, it is such a joy to have you on the show today. We were chatting beforehand, and I can't believe it's been 4 or 5 years since the last one. But thank you so much for joining me again today.
My pleasure, Harry, man. It's good to be here. It's been a minute.
Now, I do want to start, because it has been an incredible journey since the last show. So I want to start on that. And for those that maybe missed the first episode, take us back to the beginning. What was that founding aha moment for you with Qualtrics? And then we're going to dive right in.
People ask me that, like, where has the aha moment been? And with Qualtrics, I don't think there's ever really been an aha moment. There hasn't been this tipping point where it like all worked. It's been what I would call probably more push than pull the whole way. Part of that's probably the mindset of the people running it, where we're never satisfied. So we never like wake up and like smell the roses and say, oh, we've arrived. It's actually been the opposite. It's been like nothing but paranoia and like how we go win in the market. And every time we get to a plateau, we've already set our sights on the next plateau and the next plateau. And I think the awakening for me is like, we're about the journey. Like, we're all about the journey. And tech's an interesting place, because if you think about it, you're sitting in a basement of a house and you're sitting there going, man, I wish our product would be good so that people could use it. I wish we could actually have money to hire employees. I wish we could have marketing. I wish that we could go somewhere and people would actually know who we were. And we're just dreaming with like all of our souls that we could get to that point. And then what happens is like you get to a point where people do know who you are and your products do work. And then the natural natural inclination of the tech world is, oh, we're too big now. I want to go back to the basement. I want to go do a startup. And it's like this crazy hamster wheel. And it's like, we always said, well, if we ever get to that point, we're going to rally it. We're never going to wish we were back, because that's like hell. Because the basement sucked. It was like the worst time I've ever had, like running a business. And we always wished to be where we are today. And then you get to where you dreamed to, and then you want to go back to where it wasn't good. And that's the cycle I watch in tech all the time. I watch this cycle where people want to do that. And so I always just said, when we get here, we're going to rally it. We're going to go take it to the next level.
Can I ask you a question? It's like, you know, I have a therapist today, and they often tell me, Harry, if you're always looking to the next thing, you're never going to appreciate and be happy in the moment. But scaling a business, you're always looking at scaling next quarter. You're always looking at the next big customer. How do you think about being happy in the moment, but also being ambitious to want to ramp next quarter and want to do more and more?
Well, I think first of all, if your happiness is tied up in your business, you're never going to be happy, because it's nothing but problems, whether it's customer problems, whether it's employee problems, whether it's just frustration. Like, you've got to find happiness outside. And it's one of the biggest problems I see in tech is we're all so good at what we do, and what makes us great will also kill us. And so whatever that center of gravity, whatever that peace, whether it's family, whether it's spiritual, whether it's who you are, like, that's got to carry the day. And you've got to bring that with you to what you do in tech and your job. If you don't have that, you are going to be a miserable human being, because tech will eat you up, because it's a constant state of innovation.
Can I ask the question then? This is probably the most expensive therapy session ever if you to bill me in billable hours. But it's like, how do you think about detachment then? Because it's like, when Qualtrics is your life for so long, and it's so much of your day and so much of your time, how does one detach themselves from their business and not tie happiness to the progression of their business, which I most definitely do?
Yeah, that's the big challenge. I mean, I'm in my 20th year. It's 20 years, right? And first, I think people need to understand how long they're going to work. If you know how long you're going to work, I learned this lesson from an individual back in 2007, 2008, 2009, where I was this young kid. And I go back to the like Hamilton play where like you're trying so hard and you want it so fast, and it's like, slow down. There's so many things. Like, he was always writing like it was going out of style, right? That's how we all are, right? We're all like trying so fast. And I had an individual come up to me and said, hey, Ryan, he was 68 and he was still working. He was actually helping me as a board member. He's like, how long are you going to work? I was like, I don't see myself ever stop working. And he's like, okay, you probably need to change your perspective that you're going to be doing this for 60 years. And too many people are sitting here going like, I'm going to come in, I'm going to get a hit, and then I'm going to pop out, and I'm going to ride off into the sunset. And reality is most of us aren't built like that. That would be the most miserable thing we ever did. And so once you understand a little bit about how you're actually going to react, then I think you can look at detachment and say, hey, it's probably much more like integration. Like Elon, you already know Elon's always going to be working. You already know that. He's not going to stop, like, ever, 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 ever. So like, you've got to take that perspective into place where it's like, hey, I have to figure out how to have peace in my life at some point. And it's going to be much more integration. And, you know, what you can't have it become is that Qualtrics or whatever you're working on is your full identity. Like, my identity is that I'm Jet's dad. I'm Ashley's husband. And today there's a dance show from my wife's studio that, like, it's our Super Bowl today. It's her day. It's our kids' day. You have to be able to do that. And that's where there's a difference between, I would say, focus and being all in versus your identity. And I can't be the Qualtrics guy. Like, people are like, oh, you're the Qualtrics guy. You're the Qualtrics guy. And it's like, that's not who I am. It's what I do. That's not who I am.
How did your actions change post hearing that from that board member 13 or 14 years ago?
Well, I don't think what I did changed. I think how I thought about, first of all, it was something that was truth. Like, I know without a doubt, I will work in my 80s. If I'm around that long, I will work in my 80s. I just know that's how I'm built. And everyone, they have enough data to look at themselves and say, yeah, if I had enough money to go sell off into the sunset, I'm not selling off into the sunset. I'm not flying to Vegas to go live it up and like check out. You know that about yourselves. That's something you do know. And so if you know, have an idea that, hey, I'm always going to be doing something, then it should change how you look at the journey a little bit. And maybe at the end of the day, when you're dealing with problems, when you don't think you can go any further, when you couldn't do this, you've got to look at yourself going, hey, I've got to pace myself. I mean, I'll tell you, this season, I took over the Utah Jazz and we started off the year 4-4. So we'd won 4 and lost 4. And we have a really amazing team. And I remember like the general manager calling me going, Ryan, hey, this is going to get worse before it gets better. You need to pace yourself. And I remember talking to him and I talking to coach and saying, hey, guys, I'm chill. I'm not going to panic. I'm doing this for 35 years. The last person who ran the team had it for 35 years. I'm doing this for 35 years. And really, that's my thought. Like, we're doing it for that long. And so that changed the way I looked at starting 4-4. And, you know, we've got the best record in the league now. And so I think it's an interesting kind of snapshot there where if you know how long you're going to do it, it helps you through situations where it's probably not going the way you want.
It's interesting. You said that, like, it's not who I am in terms of sailing off into the sunset. I think a challenge for me and probably for a lot of people now in tech is like, Ryan, I started, I mean, when we spoke last, I was 18. You know, I started when I was 16. I don't honestly, like, I think it'd be arrogant almost for me to say I have any idea who I am. I've been like wedded to a recording studio for the last 7 years. I don't think I have the ability to say that is who I am or that's not who I am because this is all I've ever known. I guess what advice would you give to me?
I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. Like, I don't know. And reality is, like, if you read Clayton Christensen's book, How Will You Measure Your Life? He talks about how he wanted to be the editor for the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, whichever one it was. And here he was, like, a famous Harvard professor. And he's like, I'll get there someday. And he's like in his 60s, right? And so I think it's natural. And one of the things we saw with the pandemic is everyone, like, woke up and said, oh, wow. And they started having that conversation of, what do I want to be when I grow up? And it was like dangerous. Like you saw all these people doing all these irrational things where it's like, I quit my job. And it's like, I mean, personally, you just put your head down and work and you try to be opportunistic. I think if you're opportunistic, opportunities will come up. I mean, we sold our company, obviously, to SAP in 2018, right? So the end of 2018. So we're in 2019. We go through a year. And then the pandemic hits. And it's funny. Once we sold to SAP, every single person in tech told me what was going to happen. They all said, this is what's going to happen. I've seen the playbook. You're going to go into a big company. They're going to squeeze you. This is what all the... And then, like, it was unanimous. Like, I've seen this before. My friend was acquired or when I was at this company. I mean, we had 20% of our employees come in and be like, hey, I didn't sign up for this. We were going to go public and we were going to do that. And this is everything that's going to happen. And I'm about 16 months in and I sit down with our new CEO and said, hey, like, look, here are our options. Qualtrics is growing. It's on fire. Why don't we look at another formula? And by July, we had spun it out. We were on the path to go public. And so every single person was wrong. And so we're 18 months in. We spin it out. We have an IPO in January. We kind of got it really in August on the rails. And so if you go back to June, I'm sitting here in June running a company in hypergrowth within SAP. And if you would have told me a month later, we would have had a company on track to go public and I would have the team I grew up cheering for, Utah Jazz, under contract, I would have said, you're crazy. Like, I would have said, there's no way. And both of those happened from 1 month to another during a pandemic. And so I think that you've just got to be opportunistic with what's coming, and you're going to end up in a place of what you want to be is probably not the best way, but you'll be in a place that probably fits what you should be doing.
Can I ask, how do you think about your relationship to risk? Because when you think about opportunistic and grasping opportunities when they come and taking them, there's the element of risk inherent within everything. How do you think about your relationship to risk and how you evaluate risk today?
I've always viewed myself as, like, I know a lot of entrepreneurs who are not great entrepreneurs. They just start stuff and never finish. I would much rather be opportunistic than being an entrepreneur. And I think sometimes with entrepreneurship, the risk boogie person or that hurdle gets so high. A lot of times with opportunities, the risk isn't that high because you're starting from where you are and you're just moving along. I recently interviewed for a thing we did called Work Different. I interviewed Tom Brady, the quarterback. And I asked him the same question. I said, hey, look, man, you got 6 Super Bowl rings. You're in the winningest franchise. You're the winningest player over the last 20 years. And you're going to the losingest franchise over that same time period. And you go in and you pick up another Super Bowl ring. Like, you didn't have to do this, man. Like, why'd you do it? And his response was just fear and risk basically have no place. They don't do anything. And I tend to agree with that. Like, there's no benefit from it anywhere in life. However, I do believe that whatever our rubric is personally for making decisions, calculating risk is really interesting. And if you can get good at calculating those risks and however you go through your decision process is really good. Like, we have this thing called one-way and two-way doors. I think we got it from Amazon back in the day. Like, at Qualtrics, like, we want to run fast. How do you become hyper-growth, but how do you also be cash flow positive? How do you be responsible? How do you build a good culture? But how do you run as fast as you can? And so we have this thought where it's like, look, when you come up on a point, an inflection point, a decision point, a risk, whatever it is, look at it. And this is really simple. And everyone out there, everyone listening can use this. When you come up on a juncture, you have two options. You ask yourself, is this a one-way door or a two-way door? A two-way door, you can run through as fast as you can. And if it's not going well, you just turn around and come back out. It's like an off-ramp. But a one-way door is a door that you're going through. And you know, if you don't get it right, you're stuck. So if you're giving out equity of your company, it's a one-way door. You can't get it back. You know, oftentimes if you're hiring someone, it can be a two-way door. If it doesn't work out, you part ways. And so I think if you look at risk and everyone sees, run as fast as you can, but just pump the brakes if you think it's a one-way door. And if it's not a one-way door, just go.
Can I ask, when you have that decision-making rubric, and I love that as a rubric, the other element, if you dig down a little bit, is head versus heart. And, you know, the heart can guide you in one way, the head can guide you in another, dependent on one way or two way. How do you think about head versus heart in decision-making? And does that impact your decision-making?
The older I get, I lead with my heart. I just do. Right or wrong, it's just, that's pretty consistent. And I don't know if it's my heart, my soul, my gut, whatever you want to call it, but the head's got to come up with really an idea or whatever else it is. But at the end of the day, I have enough repetitions to know that some of my biggest regrets are actually the ones when I didn't trust my gut or my heart.
I mean, it's interesting. You said the word there, regret. I obviously stalked the shit out of you over the last few days. You tweeted one. I love your Sunday thoughts, by the way. They're some of my favorites. But you tweeted one from Trevor Noah, which is, we spend so much time being afraid of failure, but actually regret is the thing we should fear the most. You mentioned regret there. How do you think about regret today? How do you think about your relationship with it? You know, I have them, they haunt me. How would you describe yours?
Yeah, when you're looking at risk or you're looking at different situations, I'll often ask myself and make the decision simply based on, back to that rubric, do I believe I'm going to regret this? And you normally know in the moment, can I live with myself? I had 2 hours to decide whether we're selling to SAP for $8 billion cash. I had to be able to ask myself in 2 hours, am I going to regret this? Am I going to regret not going public? Am I going to regret turning the money down? There wasn't a lot of time.
What's interesting though there is, like, you would think that's a one-way door, bluntly. You sell the company, that's a one-way door. But actually it's not, is it?
Well, it turned out not to be a one-way door. And for most people, it probably would have been. And I would say even for us, it probably would have been. But both us, and credit to SAP, we've been super optimistic. And what I would call an opportunist kind of mentality here, where we came out and said, hey, look, there's a chance here. And part of that's because the business did so well within SAP. Like, it doesn't do well. I lose all the employee base and everyone jams. Like, there's nothing left. Or if I leave and the management team leaves, there's nothing left. But because we stayed intact, because we kept our culture, because we did this, you have a chance to spin it out for much higher later. But I think back to the real crux of it is you just got to be real and try to be honest with yourself and kind of just go through a little bit of simulation in your mind going, hey, can I live with this? Am I going to regret it? Can I live with this? And you know what you can live with. You truly do. I mean, like, for example, in 2011, someone offered us $500 million cash to sell our business. And we were at this point where we turned it down. I'll never forget. I'm sitting there with Michael Moritz from Sequoia, and he's looking across from me and he's like, Ryan, this is like the perfect litmus test for me as an investor. And this is a dude that gave Steve Jobs his first dollar, right? Like, this is the dude that funded Larry and Sergey. And I'm this kid from Provo, Utah that flew out. I never even knew what Sand Hill Road was, right? And he's looking at me going, if I invest in you and you turn the money down, you're exactly what I'm looking for. And do you want to actually do something interesting, or do you want to be another company in Utah that sells out too soon? And I was like, well, I want to be interesting, man. I want to be interesting. And for me to turn down the $500 million and to be able to not have regret, we had to raise capital at that point because we were bootstrapped. And we could have kept bootstrapping for 10 more years. Our financial business, it was unbelievable. But everyone says, why did you raise money? Well, we raised money because we had an offer to sell the company. And to be able to live with ourselves, we had to raise some capital, and it was secondary to be able to say, hey, look, this is what works, so we didn't regret. And that's a little bit of a decision process that no one would think that's why we raised venture capital. We actually raised venture capital because we turned down an offer and we wanted to be able to live with ourselves.
Having turned down that and then obviously having accepted SAPs, how did it feel when you accepted? I think a lot of entrepreneurs dream of that day, that big exit, that TechCrunch article, the multi-billion dollar sale. How did it feel when you actually sold?
Yeah, Harry, I'll just be super straight because and this is probably weird to say, but if there's entrepreneurs out there listening, this is probably the single piece of advice that I could give. You know, it was a cash deal. The day that the wires hit, I remember sitting, we were at a president's club. So we were at a sales retreat with all of our people. And you could kind of look around and you could see everyone's phones, right? Like people were like with their spouses, like, and it was pretty clear that like things had funded, right? And I remember turning to my wife, just like showing her the phone. You'd see a bunch of zeros, right? And she was like, oh, scary. And I think it was probably the most underwhelming day of my entire career. You know, we owned a lot of the company, right? And it was pretty interesting that in the eyes of the world, everyone saw that as success. But like, it wasn't this eureka moment at all. And it wasn't until we saw a bunch of other young kids and families and people actually feel the success that it actually meant anything. And so I think that the lesson is, if you are doing this and you think, oh, I'm going to build a company and I'm going to raise a bunch of funding and I'm going to exit and I'm going to get some money, it's going to be the most underwhelming moment that you've had in your career. You have to find another reason to do this.
Can I ask you, Ryan, you know, you have an incredible relationship with your wife. In that process, when you had the 2 hours, I'm sure you called her. I'm sure she advised you on, you know, different offers you had beforehand. What did your wife say in terms of the advice when it came to selling?
When the 500 offer came, we got in the car and we drove south in Utah, right? And we started driving south and we were going to drive down to like where Arches is and the national park down by Zion. We got about 45 minutes away and she's like, look, man, I don't want you home more. Like, nothing's going to be good with you with that kind of money and nothing to do. Like, is it all going to go away? And I'm like, no, like, actually, the business is really solid. We're growing. Everything's good. And she's like, just go for it. Like, you're young. You're 32 years old. Like, let's go. And so I think she's been pretty inspirational. I truly believe that you need someone by you that will tell you the truth. You need someone by you. Like, you know, everyone thinks balance is like the wings of the plane flying perfectly parallel and everything going. And it's really not. Like, one wing of your plane is always in the water. It's always tipped. And you need someone who's going to be like, hey, look, man, your wing's down. You're going to get in a rut. Like, you got to course correct. And one wing's always down. And it's always going to be that it's hell month at Qualtrics, or we're doing our big summit, or this is going on, or it's the end of the quarter, or on the family side, like, we've got something going on. And you just need people around you who are going to tell you the truth and help tell you, like, you're off balance. And it's okay. Like, get that up. And for me, it's been my wife. It's also been my brother, who you said you spoke with. And, you know, Jared's been as great of a mentor. Is, you know, I recruited him out of Google in 2008. I mean, he was early Google, running Google China. And Jared's 4 years older than me. So growing up, like, we were super different. And, you know, he's kind of the sibling that's 4 years older, where you kind of had a relationship, but you didn't. And we weren't that close. And I recruited him to come back, and he really didn't want to come back and do Qualtrics. And I knew he was good. I knew he was a good product person, but I had no clue how good he was. And he's one of the best in the world. Everyone knows that now. Like, Jared is a freak. But he became, like, Qualtrics would not be where it is at all without Jared. And he's been one where he just would tell me the truth. Like, Ryan, let me tell you where your blind spots are. I mean, he would say that all the time. Like, it just unapologetically, like, look, man, like, you're off here. And entrepreneurs a lot of times don't want that.
It's interesting you said that about Jared, because I asked Jared, what are Ryan's biggest weaknesses? And he answered every question completely unflapping and brilliantly. That one, he said, you know what? You should ask Ryan this one. Let him be self-reflective. I don't know if he's just, like, completely screwed you on that one. But if we do that, what do you think are your biggest weaknesses from Jared handing that over to you?
Wow. I mean, to be honest with you, there's probably too many to count. Like, if you ask Jared and I together, I think that our response would be Jared's weaknesses are my strengths and vice versa, right? Because we've worked together so long, we've grown, and we're like opposites. Like, we both kind of majored in where each other was weak. And so together, it would be the perfect team. And what I've tried to do is say, okay, where do I major and where do I minor? So if I were to say, hey, strengths, obviously go to market, positioning, branding. I think I'm pretty good at product. Where I've been horrible over the years is just long-term impact of either internal operational decisions. But I mean, it's hard to run a bit. I've run every part of Qualtrics and it's gone pretty well. But, you know, sometimes I'm way too emotional. That's a bad thing. I've tried to work on that over the years. I think I've gotten better. I think one of the weaknesses, I'm probably never satisfied, right? And that can get pretty annoying to work with me.
Can I touch on another area? We spoke about, you know, your wife and her advice. The other element that's really interesting, I've spoken to quite a few founders about this. I remember speaking to, you know, Vlad at Robinhood. And it's when you have big exits like you have done, your children are also brought up just by nature in different environments to those in which you were. How do you think about instilling the same values that you were brought up with in your children, who just by nature, as I said, are brought up in very different circumstances?
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, Jared and I talk about this a lot. I mean, there's four boys. We have one girl who's the oldest, Tanya, and then four boys. And I was with my brother last night down in LA at the basketball game. And we always talk about, you know, my parents split up when I was 13 years old, and we kind of had to figure it all out. You know, Jared moved out of the house as a 17-year-old. He started working at WordPerfect as a product guy at 16. And he had to, you know, he had to figure it out. Like, he was a whiz kid. He was managing a team of eight executives at 18 years old. And trying to replicate that, given my new world, is going to be impossible, right? Like, the world's different. Our upbringing's different. I mean, obviously, both my parents were academics, so they didn't have a ton of money. And our worlds are different. And so I think that, I mean, education's a massive priority for us, not because I think it's the only way, but because it does instill hard work. Right or wrong, if someone's excelling in education, like, there is a work ethic. I think that's the one thing that I would say accidentally all the Smith kids had to figure out was how to work. And that's what I want from my job. I want them to be nice kids. I want to be nice and learn how to treat people. I want them to learn how to care. I want to be mission driven, but I also want them to really, really learn how to work. Jared is one of the hardest workers I know. And whether you're smart or not, like, one of the problems I see in part of our younger generation, they don't grind. They don't grind the way that we have. And if I look at Qualtrics, it's been a 20-year grind. I want my kids to be able to stick with it. Like, I probably quit Qualtrics 50 times. And I want my kids to be able to figure out like how to hang in there. And whether you call it grit, whether you call it something else, like that's what you've got to instill. And if you can do that while they're growing up, obviously in a different world than I did, that's hard. And how they get there, whether it's academics or sports or whatever else, or just that they're born with it, I don't know. Good question.
One final one before the quickfire. And it's like one thing I always struggled with was, you know, my mother was diagnosed with MS when I was young. And, you know, I was forced to kind of be a carer. And there was the inversion of the role of carer to carry much sooner than one would expect in a parental relationship. And that weight of responsibility weighed on me a lot. I mean, I think I did okay in the end, but it did weigh on me. It still does. Did that weigh on you and Jared? As you said that, Jared being a product manager at 16, managing execs at 18, this is quite atypical for a teenager to go through. Did that weigh on you? And did you think about it?
I mean, like at the time, you're just surviving, right? You're just doing what you do. And I was telling someone yesterday that like, I was 14 years old and my friend was 15 and neither one of us had driver's licenses, and we drove 3 hours away for this sports tournament and hung out there all weekend. And it's like, where were our parents? Like, that just doesn't happen in today's world, right? It was just the way it was. Like at the time, I remember it being hard. And I remember my father saying, hey, you're going to appreciate this later. You're going to appreciate this later. You're going to appreciate this later. And I think there's a strong lesson that people need to understand is that tomorrow always comes, right? It always comes. And the better you can help understand, this is one of the things that Jared's taught me, is we're dealing with whether it's infrastructure, internal systems, employee decisions, equality within our company, is like tomorrow will always be there. You're never going to be able to get up. And so you're going to be stuck with the decisions you make. And so ultimately you can either fight it and say, hey, look, I'm not going to learn and I'm going to take shortcuts, which was my whole modus operandi growing up, because that's how I was. But ultimately, I had to actually get in the saddle and ride. And that's part of who shapes you and what becomes of you and like everything else. And like, I dropped out of high school 2 years in and then graduated and then went to Seoul, Korea to go teach English. And then, I mean, I was a total screw up kid. And then in Korea, I moved in with a bunch of guys that like I really admired. And then I'm 18 years old and then decided to go do a 2-year LDS mission. And I went from Seoul, Korea to Mexico City for 2 years. So literally I came back at 21. I had never been to college. I hadn't been in the United States in 3 or 4 years. And I said, wait, I want to go to college. And they're like, I don't even know that you finished high school. And I wanted to go to a specific university at Brigham Young because I love their business program. But you need like a 3.9 GPA and a 31 on the ACT. And 4 quarters later, I'm in that school. And if you look at the kid who was sitting there at 16 versus a kid at 21 and the experiences that had happened to him from Korea to Mexico, that's what I hope my kids can have. And I don't know how to manufacture that experience, because for me, it was out of necessity. And then if you look at what happened once I got into school, I'm in the business school. I start Qualtrics. I meet my wife. Life took off.
I love that. And in terms of what you do in terms of the children, I'd A-B test it. I'd send one to Korea and one to Mexico and see how they turn out.
Yeah, I do that.
No, definitely don't. Your wife will not be so thrilled with you. I do want to move into a quick fire. So tell me, what's the favorite book and why, Ryan?
I like The Alchemist because it's this really cool story about how like the journey comes full speed and what you're looking for is normally right in front of you.
Jared told me I had to ask about doubles. What does he mean?
Sometimes you have to change the way you work. And Kim Scott, who's one of Jared's friends and my friend, is a board member and advisor and CEO coach. She always talked about doubles and triples where there's not enough time in the day. So, you know, I'll never forget a couple years ago, I was talking to Kim about how I couldn't do it all. Being a good dad, being a husband, being all the responsibilities in my life. And she's like, why don't you double or triple them up? And so I remember that Monday, my wife said, hey, I've got to teach dance, because she's a dance teacher. I got to teach dance. You've got the kids. And I looked at everything I had to do and it was like, okay, my grandmother's turning 80 and I need to do that. I got to go to dinner. I have to teach my 4-year-old how to ride a bike and I don't have time. Like I'm failing at everything. And I was like, I'm going to try this. So I grabbed the kids. I threw them in the car. I grabbed my daughter's bike. I threw it in the car. We went and got Wendy's. We went over to my grandmother's house, pulled her out onto her driveway. The kids ate. My daughter rode her bike in front of grandmother, and that was a triple. I got three things done in 1 hour, right? And so you'll always see me doubling up everything I do. Like, if I have a meeting that I need to go do, I'll just bring them with me to the next meeting. If I've got to go to a game, I've always got people with me that I was supposed to meet with. And we just do it as we go. And it actually works really, really well.
What do you know now that you wish you'd known when you started Qualtrics in the basement 20 years ago?
I would just go back to that kid and just be like, hang in there, man. Just keep going. Trust your gut.
What three traits do you most want your children to adopt?
I think number one is just like honesty and integrity. Jared always says, and we have this thing at Qualtrics, that there's no minor lapse of integrity. So I think that's it. Obviously hard work. And then I'd want my kids to be wise. You know, people who are wise beyond their years are typically the ones, and in learning mode, they're the ones that you want to be around.
What's the biggest misnomer about being acquired?
I think that everyone tells you how it's going to go.
And it doesn't go that way.
They're wrong.
Penultimate one. Who's the best board member that you've worked with and why?
The best board member? Wow, you're asking me to like choose my kids. To be honest with you, I'll tell you, one of the most influential board members we've had, there's probably two. One gentleman's named Duff Thompson, who was at WordPerfect back in the day. And WordPerfect had the market share and the lead, and they were fighting against Microsoft. And WordPerfect lost the processor, the business to Microsoft Word, and they bundled, and then they sold to Novell. And it didn't work out the way that it probably could have. And they missed a window from being the biggest player. And Duff, having Duff on our board as our chairman, and be able to go through what went wrong and why and what part of the journey I need to enjoy, and just the deep care about me personally versus like when to step on the gas and how you never know, and being 30 years later having regrets on what they did or excitement about what they did right. I think oftentimes we bring board members in who life's only gone good for. And it's one of our problems in tech is like we need to bring people in that, you know, have some battle wounds. And like maybe there was some successes that happened, but also some things that didn't work out, and like what they would have you learn about. And Duff's been as influential as anyone on the board. And I think also with my board members, like if you look at Ryan Sweeney or Brian Schreier or Jeff Lee, we kind of grew up together, right?
Totally. It's been a long and incredible journey together. And I have to thank pretty much all of them for seeding me with questions today. I do want to finish on one final one. And it's, you've also put as a Sunday thought, it's not about where we're going, but it's about who we want to become. How do you think about that today? Who do you want to become?
I mean, I know the attributes of what I want to become. And I think it's very aspirational because I think you have to do it on a daily basis. But I think it probably goes back to the identity question. You know, I was at someone's funeral and they said, they were talking about an individual who I totally admire. And the person speaking said, this person was reliable. This person was reliable to everyone around them. They were reliable to their family. They were reliable as a friend. They were reliable to their God. They were reliable to everything. I thought that was one of the greatest compliments I've ever heard, that this person could be count on and they were there and everything. And, you know, I'm still trying to figure that out. I think too many people try to figure out what their legacy is, and you really don't determine your legacy like other people do. And I think you just need to do your best in the moment and try to be guided by principles. And I think one of the biggest fears I have a little bit with tech right now is we're not guided by great principles. And you've got to figure out, like, it's not about the money. It's not about always being popular. Like, what do you stand for? What do you truly stand for? And not being predictable about what you stand for because everyone else stands for that. Like, what do you stand for as an individual that's different? Like, why? And what's amazing about our community and our world is like people accept you for who you are. And I hope truly that more and more entrepreneurs and founders will show who they are. I don't shy away from anything. I've always just been Ryan, you know, whether it's through Sunday Thoughts or growing up. Like, I only have one story. It's me. It's too hard to keep of another story. And I think we can all work on who we are because I think we all bring something. And so that's a tough question. It's a real tough question on what I want to become. But I think most of it's off the tech realm, where it really comes down to what I want my kids to be able to say their dad was, and my friends and my family. You know, at the end of the day, whether we launch another product or something like that, that's probably not going to be what determines what I become. And if it is, that's pretty hollow. It's really what people are going to say about you at your funeral.
You know, I think for me, when I do the shows, bluntly, very few stand the test of time, Ryan. You know, people listen, people love it, and then people move on. This was a really, really special one. I mean, I had this great schedule and I completely left it aside. So I'm glad you didn't see the schedule because I didn't ask any of the questions on it. But I can't thank you enough. This was really a very special one for me.
Keep up the good work.
I mean, my word, I just love that conversation. I don't think enough people have the ability to be as real as Ryan was there and have the vulnerability to share like Ryan did there. And so huge thanks to Ryan for being so fantastic in that discussion. As I said, totally off script, but makes it so much more special. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, of course you can on the site, the20minutevc.com. I'd love to see you there. But before we leave you today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of the incredible platform that is AngelList on the business side there, on the personal side, Harness is the next generation wealth management solution created for builders, individuals founding, scaling, and investing in businesses. And if you're like me and not ready for an ongoing advisory relationship, then simple. Schedule a 1-hour tax planning session with a tax advisor experienced in working with equity. The accountant will review your equity and tax documents, answer any questions you may have, and provide projections for potential equity decisions. But don't just take my word for it. Harness have helped founders and early employees at companies like Stripe, UiPath, Affirm, and Coinbase capture more value with their finances. Go to harnesswealth.com/the20minutevc to sign up. Plus 20 VC listeners can receive $100 off their first year fees when they sign up for an advisor on the Harness platform by entering the 20 minute VC08. And speaking of wealth management with Harness there, Masterworks is the first platform for buying and selling shares representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in the most incredible blue chip art so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. And with more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So it's time to build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks. And you can find out more today at masterworks.io. As always, I so appreciate all your support and I can't wait to bring you an incredible episode this coming Thursday.